This week on Retronauts, we bone up on Grim Fandango. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and this week we're bringing my LucasArts miniseries to a close by covering the one adventure game from their library we've yet to cover. And yes, technically there's one game we haven't done an episode about yet, but I'll get to why we're not doing that very, very soon. Before I continue, who is our returning guest on this podcast?
Cole Ross. Yeah, I forget. Do we do the tags? Slayer of the Mighty Robert Frost?
Hey, that works. That works. And Cole, you've been with us for a few of these episodes. As far as I can remember, Full Throttle. No, sorry. Sam and Max and I believe Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And oh, yeah, Fate of Atlantis, too.
Yeah, I've been on three of these before. That's wild. Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be back for this one.
And Cole, of course, is a seasoned adventure game podcaster. You've covered plenty of them on Watch Out for Fireballs over the past decade plus.
Yes, yeah, including many LucasArts games. So this is this right at home coming back to this one.
And we also have a new guest on the program. New guest, please introduce yourself and let us know who exactly you are.
Hey, it's me, Everdred. I'm sort of a weird internet kind of guy, just out there. I've helped out with some random things back in the day and always happy to talk about a cool game at length, hopefully. But please go easy on me. This is my first time not only on your show, on any show, on really doing anything too significant. So I can't make any promises. My apologies if I am not in the game as hard as both of you, but I'm really excited to be here and thanks for having me.
Hey, this is a great first podcast to be on because I think my first podcast was me making jokes with my friends and about three people heard it. So this is a good way to start your podcasting career, Everdred, talking about Grim Fandango. Before I continue, we always like to ground the discussion in context, and I really want to know where everybody is coming from with their history with Grim Fandango. Let's start with Everdred. Everdred, where are you coming from? What is your history with this game?
Let's see. I remember playing it, I think in 98, I think at launch, and The biggest thing that I remember about it was getting horribly stuck year two. Couldn't get any farther. I didn't have a strategy guide, and that was murdersome trying to get through the game. And I know I gave up at that point. I didn't actually play through completely until a few years later. I think I was in college. And I honestly got way more out of the game. I was like 10 or 11 at launch in 98. So when I was in college, this game was like, oh, I need to go back and have the time that I didn't ever get to have. And it was such a wonderful time. And then I've played it every so often throughout the years, but it's actually been quite a while since I'd played it again. I knew of Remastered. I knew I needed to play it, but I forgot that it added in mouse controls. And the classic issue that I always had was the tank controls did me in. Like I could get deep into it and then I just would eventually stop because of the traversal sort of stuff. So my experience with this game is really, even back in the day when I was a kid, I loved the aesthetic, the style, really wanted to play it, but had limitations on how much I could really get into it.
Yes, and we'll talk about it soon, but the tank controls were put in at the insistence of Tim Schafer, which is why there is an achievement on the remastered version that says, beat the entire game with tank controls. The description is, Tim made us put this in, or something like that. He admits it was a huge mistake, but Cole, where are you coming from with your relationship with Grim Fandango?
Yeah, with Grim Fandango specifically. So I was not really a PC gamer in the late 90s. It wasn't until the early 2000s when I was getting into like late middle school, early high school that I was kind of catching up on a lot of these games. And I had read about Grim Fandango, knew it from its reputation, was looking into getting, just finding more of these story-rich games that were in the vein of the first of these that I played, which was Maniac Mansion. And so Grim Fandango was not in print anymore, I don't think, at that point in about 2002, 2003. So this was actually the first thing that I bought off of the internet. And by I bought, I mean I cajoled my grandparents into ordering it for me off of the LucasArts website to get the jewel case version of it. And I love it. This was kind of a starting point for, really appreciating film noir vibes, my kind of first real exposure to a work that use those in earnest, for as comedic as this is, you know. So like, first thing that was not like an Animaniacs goof where they were doing a Humphrey Bogart thing for a little bit. And also my, you know, one of my first exposures to this kind of Day of the Dead mythology, Aztec afterlife kind of stuff. And just, yeah, I don't know. It was a start for a lot of things for me.
Yeah, I was a slightly an early adopter on this game. I didn't get it this season it came out, because we'll talk about it soon, but it came out at a very interesting time for games, in which the biggest and most influential games of the next, I don't know, 20 years would be coming out alongside Grim Fandango. So it was a time to be alive. I got it later that year, like in 99, maybe summer of 99. I was visiting California. A friend was staying with his dad. I had some extra spending money. We played through a bit of the first year on his computer. I think I brought it back home and basically had to resort to using a walkthrough in order to finish the game.
Makes sense.
And yeah, I've always like half attempted to get through the game several times after that, where I'd usually stall out at some point. And then when the remastered version came out, I was reviewing that in 2015 for US Gamer, and that's when I decided to, you know, fully engage with the game as an adult. And it was at that point I walked away thinking, I love everything about this game except playing it. This should be anything except for a video game, but we can explore that more later. But a huge amount of respect for this game, but it is really constrained by the format and the context in which it was released that basically made that format necessary. So yeah, conflicting feelings on Grim Fandango, but there's a lot I love about it. So I should note that this episode is timed to launch us alongside two things. Well, number one, this is Spooky Skellington Month. We're in October, so boo, I guess. And also, my Boss Fight Books volume on Day of the Tentacle is now out physically. It's been out digitally for a while, but if you haven't gotten a copy yet, you can go to the Boss Fight Books website or anywhere else you can find books, and you can order a copy there. But that is why there will not be a Day of the Tentacle episode of Retronauts for this miniseries. You got to pay for it, buddy. I spent 5 years writing that book. It seems a little, impractical maybe, but hey, I would like you to buy my book. So please check that out if you would like my treatment on Day of the Tentacle. It's a very in-depth oral history. I talk to everybody involved with the game. And it is my life's work, and I doubt I'll write another book ever in my life. So please check that out. And I never covered the first LucasArts adventure game, which is Labyrinth. That is the a game based on the famous movie from the mid-80s. Maybe I'll find some way to talk about it, but it's so slight and so primitive that it's hard to justify making an entire episode just about that. But maybe I'll find some way to talk about it. So before we begin talking about the game and the specifics about the game, I should note that it's very available in many forms thanks to the 2015 remastered edition, which is on everything and seemingly always on sale. We won't talk too much about this edition on the episode, although it's the one I assume we all played for this podcast, but it's worth it for everything involved. There are no downsides to this edition of the game. You can play with tank controls. You can play with camera relative controls. You can play with a mouse, finally. And the soundtrack is better. It sounds better than the initial version. And also, the polygonal graphics have been made at a higher resolution. They don't add many polygons, or actually they add zero polygons, so everything is a Dorito explosion on the screen. But there are really no downsides. And a great commentary, too. A great commentary track.
Is wonderful. Going through this game again with a commentary on, hearing each of the... they had different groups of devs in different specific rooms. Each room generally has at least one commentary track for it. And it's so interesting hearing them go into detail about their experiences, and just so many Tim just little asides about his memories. And it's like, I can listen to that for hours and hours. Or really, it's one of those things that adds so much to the experience.
And I think you can listen to the commentary tracks, even if you're a first time player,
because
I was listening to all of the commentary once again, and I noticed they're very careful about where they place the commentaries and when they update the commentaries, so they're not spoiling story or puzzles. They may kind of hint at a puzzle solution, but frankly, you'll need
it's
it.
Helpful.
So don't worry
quite
about
helpful,
that.
Actually.
Yeah. So definitely recommend that. You can probably get it for under $5 every couple months. It probably will go on sale for that cheap.
Thank you.
let's talk about the history of Grim Fandango. So thankfully, a lot of the Grim Fandango fans out there have preserved a lot of the history that was online, because this game was being made when the gaming press was online, and Tim Schafer wrote these designer diaries for GameSpot back in the day that are very interesting, and it's the fly-on-the-wall perspective of him working on the game, pitching the game, and so on. So I pulled a lot from that, but it's a shame that those were just thrown away decades ago, probably, by GameSpot. But that's just the state of the internet. Articles don't last more than 5 years now, if they're lucky. So thanks to these Grim Fandango fans for putting these online. And I do want to set the context for the release of this game, because the release of Grim Fandango comes at an interesting and not great time for adventure games. So, contrary to popular belief, and this is something that I've brought up a lot on this series, they weren't getting worse. Adventure games weren't getting worse. Other games were just outselling them by magnitudes. And people, I don't think they do it anymore, because I think this website is now more forgotten than Something Awful. But the Old Man Murray site, the comedy website in which the Portal writers came from, and, you know, the Valve writers came from, they had their classic takedown of adventure games in the late 90s where, to paraphrase, they quoted, you know, adventure games killed adventure games. And that is just, that became conventional wisdom that kind of stuck around for a while, I think, until Telltale brought them back. And then we realized, like, hey, these can be fun in different ways. But I interviewed Ron Gilbert many times. And in one of the interviews, he said something I think that was very, very succinct about the state of adventure games. He said Doom is what killed adventure games, because suddenly games started selling in the millions and adventure games could never do that. So adventure games kept selling reliably, but these new action games just outsold them by magnitude. So it was not worth it for a publisher to make an adventure game. They wanted to make, let's say, Dark Forces or something like that, or Rebel Assault. So that is really where we're at right now. PC gaming is now being adopted by the mainstream. It's not just a thing for nerds, because computers are much more available to middle-class people. And Grim is trying to innovate within the genre, at least in terms of presentation, but its release of October 30th, 1998 is, to quote Jasper on The Simpsons, a time to be alive, as I said before, because this season is crazy. Just to name a few things, this season gave us Half-Life, The Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, and Metal Gear Solid. These are three games that we can still feel the impact of today in all games that we play currently. And other things that came out that season later in the year, Thief and Baldur's Gate. This is a just a big time for games that would change design forever.
For sure. I mean, even like Resident Evil 2, if you're looking to compare, you know, a similar tank control pre-render background, you know, kind of deal, making that into an action game kind of thing, you know, thinking about, you know, oh, Doom killed adventure games. You know, we're also getting into 1998 when things like web play, you know, like playing games online, you're talking about Dark Forces, you're talking about, you know, Half-Life getting in there, obviously Quake 3 coming as well. Like, PC gaming started to be more associated with things like that, where there was kind of more of a value proposition to it too. So that also could be seen as like a really rough environment for, you know, this 12-hour adventure game with a defined beginning, middle, and end, right?
And don't forget, this is, you know, the 3D camera systems. 3D cameras really having such a fun time figuring out how you even implement them, how you integrate them into the gameplay, and how you... There's so much innovation had to go down during this period that all these projects are first forays into 3D, and I know Grim Fandango was one of these big experiences into 3D for Tim and the entire company, just seeing what is possible in that space and also really trying to do their best to do the most out of it. That is not an easy task at all. And it's easy to make some, I don't want to say missteps, but errors in judgment overall about maybe the best way to handle things.
Yeah, this technology was new and they were learning it as they were making the game, and they did not have all the feedback that, you know, years of hindsight would give us. Like, so many times in Grim Fandango, you transition to a new screen, you're like, where's Manny? Where is the character I'm playing as? But, you know, they were in love with the idea of, we're going to make these big 3D environments. So when you transition to the next screen, you're going to be wowed just by how big this environment is. But then they're not thinking, like, is it going to be fun to run through this a couple thousand times between NPCs? Probably not. But, you know, this is all new to them. So we have to be a little kind, because they're just learning the tech as well. So The story of how this game got greenlit is unfortunately not very interesting, because this is Tim Schafer's big blank check game, because Tim Schafer, you know, he co-directs Day of the Tentacle with Dave Grossman, and then he pitches Full Throttle. Full Throttle is the company's biggest selling adventure game. It sells over 1 million copies, unprecedented for a LucasArts adventure game. So this is why he's able to make Grim Fandango, and given a huge period of development time, because he is their golden boy. And I feel like he was able to make this because he was explaining in many interviews, and I think Ron Gilbert and Dave Grossman have agreed with this, in that at LucasArts at this time, when they wanted you to pitch a game, they're like, okay, pitch one Maniac Mansion game, pitch one Monkey Island game, then pitch something you want to do. And I think it's because they had just made Curse of Monkey Island that a new idea like this was possible, because they weren't going to make another Monkey Island game right afterwards. And it's clear the direction the company wanted to go, because after Grim Fandango, it's like, let's do another Monkey Island, and let's do another Sam & Max, and another Full Throttle. Well, one of those actually made it out alive.
Regrettably.
And yes, unfortunately. If you want to hear me and my wife, Nina Matsumoto, complain about Escape from Monkey Island, there's a 2-hour podcast about it. We played it during some of the worst times of COVID. Not recommended. Not a good game. Not a good time to play that game.
Sounds like a bit of a downer.
Yes, yes. But Grim Fandango, much, much better than Escape from Monkey Island. So Tim Schafer got this idea before Full Throttle. Basically, an idea for a game full of folk art skeletons that would be very unique and also very easy for computers of the age to handle, because he noticed that, you know, in the mid-90s, computers could render these very low-poly things, so you couldn't render individual ribs on a skeleton, but much like the folk art skeletons, you could paint ribs on a flat texture to evoke the look of those folk art skeletons. So he thought, like, okay, this is achievable with the low-end PCs our games normally target. And Full Throttle, though, was the pitch that seemed the most conventionally successful, and it was. So that's what got picked up before the Grim Fandango pitch. So after Full Throttle, Tim Schafer goes back to this Day of the Dead concept once again. He decided, like, playing a biker was really cool. It's one of the reasons why Full Throttle flew off the shelves, because, like, okay, this is a character I haven't really played as yet in a game. So he thought, what would be cooler than playing as a biker? And the answer to that is death. What if you were Death? And this is way before Death Jr. and all of those games. So he really nailed down a unique concept with Grim Fandango. And then he needed to decide, what is this game actually about? And Tim had just seen Chinatown, and he dug the whole, like, water supply real estate scam the villain in the film was cooking up. So he blended that with Glengarry Glen Ross, and then Casablanca, to form the skeleton, no pun intended, of Grim Fandango. And then tons of other film noir movies would inform various elements of the game. But I, later in life, about a decade after Grim Fandango came out, I actually got into classic noir movies and reading crime novels, and I'm still there. And it's fun to go back with that knowledge, knowing Grim Fandango isn't parodying those genres. It has a great respect for them, like you said up front, Cole. And it's not just about, like, oh, remember Peter Lorre? Well, here's our version of him. Although they kind of do that, or like Sidney Greenstreet. But outside of a few key references, it's really into pulling from the tropes and stylized dialogue more than just saying, oh, hey, this is from Key Largo and this is from The Big Sleep. It's more about evoking the feel of that world from someone who has been steeped in the media from that certain genre.
The razor's edge that this game walks on in terms of being reverent of its source material and inspiration, but not being, like, really dry and, you know, kind of like stodgy about it, is actually, I think, really admirable. Like, it still manages to get really fun and clever jokes in, but not at the expense of what they're pulling from.
Oh yeah, it seems like so much faith in the voice actors as well, for achieving what needs to be done within the game while being able to bring in those elements. It's kind of hilarious listening to the commentary and how often, oh yeah, Tim, I remember we just wanted to go in and see the film and pull this directly from the film. You know, these little elements of how much them actively watching film noir during the experience of development, going through it and just having it. One of the big things they said was that the inspiration of it was often not a direct references or anything like that, but the idea of, like, characters and how they interact with each other, just the experiences of how you see these film noir movies in a time period that we are not used to, something authentic to them that can be pulled back in. And, but it seemed like the development, the process of pulling in from Nora was just so important to Tim, and it kind of rubbed off on everybody else within the development company.
Yeah, you're right. On the commentary, he does talk about how he was really drawn to the genre for the same reasons I find myself drawn to it, in that nobody talks like this in any other kind of genre and media. And at times it's funny, but it makes reading dialogue so entertaining. And I mean, despite being about, you know, crime and murder and adultery and all the fun topics, most of these books and movies are just fun conversations between characters. And he also said what drew him to this this genre was there were these kinds of relationships you don't see anymore that were all tied to like social rules of the time that he finds fascinating. And I like that he both takes the noir setting seriously. It's not a send-up or making fun of it. And also, the fact that the entire game is full of skeletons, they're not making, like, bone puns and things like that. I mean, there's a few skeleton jokes, but Manny's not playing his ribs like a xylophone. They're not doing, like, Laffy Taffy rapper puns or whatever. They've bought into the world, like, yes, I'm a skeleton. There is nothing funny about that. This is just what I am right now. And I like how it takes both kinds of things seriously that it's playing with.
The authenticity and coherence of that world is just second to none.
Yeah. Talking about putting this in context too, you know, thinking about noir movies, like the mid to late 90s were also a really like rich time for neo-noir as well. Like this is around the time you have Fargo coming out. This is around the time you have LA Confidential, I believe. 1998, the same year as The Big Lebowski. Like people were kind of ready for like riffs and reinterpretations, you know, on these particular tropes too.
Yeah, I believe that's also, he pulled one of the actors from The Usual Suspects into the game as
That's
well
right.
to play, I think, the tattoo, either the tattooed skeleton guy or the tattoo artist. I forget which one of those.
It was
guys
a tattoo
from,
artist. Was
yeah,
it Hungarian?
Otis.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, big fan. I mean, yeah, there was a resurgence in noir movies at the time. What also inspired Tim was Aztec mythology, based on a class he took at UC Berkeley, and then Art Deco, a design sense that was much more present in nearby San Francisco before the dot-com boom knocked down a lot of those beautiful buildings. But yeah, I mean, I lived in the Bay Area for 13 years, and a lot of them are still there. In fact, he name checks which building Manny's office building is based on. And one day I was at a game preview and I walked by that building. And I ducked my head in and it was very much the Department of Death. When you walk in, Art Deco everywhere. Yeah. And since I played this game, I've gotten really obsessed with Art Deco, and especially old movie theaters that borrow from, you know, Mayan or Aztec motifs, or even, you know, Indian motifs. People in the 20s and 30s were just so obsessed with these different cultures and, you know, using their architectural motifs to make interesting design. And I love going to like the Castro Theater and seeing that, or going to different old timey theaters in different cities and seeing just like the fascination with these cultures at the time.
About the Art Deco, I've got a serious point and a jokey point. The serious one is it was such a smart choice for like the technology that was available at the time too, because of the focus on really simple geometric shapes and curvilinear designs. You know, like you could do that really well and make it come across, you know, with the kind of pre-rendering that they were doing. My jokey point is, it was really funny when BioShock came out and everybody was losing their minds about like, oh my gosh, there's this new thing, it's called Art Deco and everybody loves it. And it's like, where were you fools at when Grim Fandango came out?
Yeah, or like Batman the Animated Series,
yeah,
for that
yeah,
matter.
True, yeah.
A few five or six years before this.
Yeah.
But so yeah, all the things that are informing this Tim Schafer game, you know, film noir, you know, Day of the Dead things, also what's in all of his games, the thing I don't really like or connect with in any way, which is car guy stuff. So, I mean, this is really present in, I forget the name of the game, Brutal Legend, there we go. Mm-hmm. Yes, the car guy stuff is really in Brutal Legend the most, but it finds its way into all of his games, and it's in this game as well with Manny. So that's, I mean, and then Full Throttle had a lot of motorcycle and car stuff as well. So you can't escape that with Tim Schafer. It's like the most masculine thing about this computer nerd who makes adventure games is that he likes car guy stuff.
Yeah, I think Tim actually mentioned that as a great unifier of a lot of different people. Like, it's something that connects with a lot of different folks. You might not expect them to be into certain hobbies, certain spaces. So the car stuff definitely makes its presence known with Glottis, right? All the way
yeah.
to the end.
And I mean, I think it's just being a different kind of nerd, because how is building a carburetor different than building a gaming PC? It's not really. In fact, building a carburetor sounds a lot harder than just slotting cards into slots, you know, and then putting a case around it. So Tim has all these ideas. There's an initial premise in the fall of 95 where Manny's more of a real estate agent in the afterlife. And after the game had the initial title of Deeds of the Dead, Tim came up with the name Grim Fandango himself. So Deeds of the Dead is a nice pun, but it's more related to real estate, which is not the premise the game went with. So Tim's like, oh, Grim Fandango, it sounds so evocative and it's so unique. And then immediately after pitching that, someone at the company is like, nobody's going to buy a game that's called that. But I think he definitely proved them wrong. This was not a flop by any means, but I like this very evocative title. Nothing else sounds like it. It's not trying to be cute like Deeds of the Dead would be. It's very nice for a title.
Yeah, it definitely sticks out.
And the company's previous game, which was Curse of Monkey Island, was a gorgeous 2D adventure game. And their only 2D adventure game in a resolution higher than 320 by 200. But because of the direction things were moving, we immediately throw away the nice 2D graphics in exchange for low polygons and pre-rendered graphics, which was the style at the time. And along with that, the Scum engine is thrown away, which was the classic engine that was everything was built on. It was improved over time, of course, but we've talked about it. It's been a while, but this lets non-programmer types actually build adventure games. It was a very simple language to use in which, you know, people could come in and be trained very easily, and good writers could become great adventure game designers very quickly. And it allowed people to improvise and change things on the fly, because the puzzles were not baked into all of the programming quite as hardcore as they would be if the system was not in place. But that's taken away, and Grim is really built on a mishmash of two things. It is the Jedi Knight Dark Forces 2 engine you're playing this game in, weirdly enough, and also the Rebel Assault 2 engine for integrating the full motion video. And one designer on the team wanted to keep the Scum spirit alive, so he started referring to the scripting language as the Grime engine. And that kind of stuck around enough where Tim Schafer said that just became the engine that we said this game runs on. It's the same for Escape from Monkey Island. That's also Grime engine, but it's not real, but it's nice to think that, you know, there was an evolution of Scum in some way.
And then the Grime engine emulator that I replayed this on in college was called Residue, which I thought was clever as well.
That is nice. And yeah, I guess this didn't always work with Scum VM.
No.
Yeah, that might have been a more recent change with Scum VM. Mm.
Yeah, I've never played this on Scum VM. But then again, since the remaster came out, I have never tried.
Yes, there's no need at all. So yeah, the skeleton characters, they really work with this lo-fi approach in terms of, you know, when it was released. And coincidentally, this game also takes place on four different Days of the Dead, in which everyone is mostly back in the land of the living visiting their families, which means all of these streets are empty. There are very few people to talk to. It's very like the premise helps make this more achievable with the technology at the time, just based on when this game is happening. So very clever, but also it makes it oftentimes a lonely game where you're just running through city streets and big empty environments.
Certainly appropriate. I love Tim commenting. He's like, oh, you ever notice there's not many crowds? Yeah, there's a good reason for that.
Yeah. Manny won't go into the one crowd you see in the entire game.
Well, the clown won't let him go into the one crowd you see.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Yes. But yeah, pointing and clicking, that is totally 1992. So this is the first LucasArts adventure game in which you are taking direct control over Manny. And we could talk about how this affects gameplay later, but on the commentary, Tim Schafer talks about his mistake for going for tank controls, because a lot of people on the team, Mario 64 had come out and they're like, let's make it like Mario where it's camera relative. But he's like, no, you're playing as Manny. We want you in his shoes and steering him around. This is not, you're not going to have the distance you have when you're pointing and clicking on a screen. But he said something really clever and insightful in that he realized later you can have a good argument for a bad thing. For a bad idea, and he said that made him watch out for that in the future. So I thought that was very insightful of him.
Yeah, that's really well put, and a good explanation of what happened here.
being able to recognize that is so important.
Absolutely. And this is, I would say, probably the biggest adventure game LucasArts made. I don't remember if Escape from Monkey Island is bigger. It just felt bigger, but because of all of the annoying puzzles. But he wanted to make this much bigger than Full Throttle, because the biggest complaint about Full Throttle is it was incredibly short. It's like a 3 or 4 hour game, even if you don't know what you're doing. This is 3 to 4 times larger, and it had an unprecedented amount of development time of 3 years. And they even wanted more, because this is not their full concept of the game fully imagined. Lots of things had to be cut, which is why the final confrontation with the big bad in this game is just basically like a 2 or 3 step puzzle. They wanted it to be much more involved. And it sounds like I said up front, this is a blank check game for Tim Schafer. No crazy deadlines. He does say that this was just constant crunch, because that's just the environment they were used to, and he realized now that that's wrong. people's internal clocks are being reset to where they were coming in at 2 a.m., and that was the start of a normal day for them. So this was 90s game development, and it was just part of the culture. And I think now that's finally being broken down. Now people are resisting, but this is just part of the spirit of what game design was like at the time.
Part of this being a larger, them intending for this to be a larger experience. I think it was like in 2009, 2010, they released a big PDF of the, I don't know that it was the design document, but it was like the puzzle doc, kind of like laying out, just on paper, the various steps that things would have to go through. And you can even see like the hooks for the extra stuff, put in there as well, when they were still like the pen and paper phase.
It seems like so much did end up having to be get cut out. That's something they refer back to constantly in the commentaries, that, oh, the experience of, this, there used to be more to this, or this had to be simplified, or something's they regrettably didn't simplify, looking back on it.
You can really feel it in Chapter 3 and beyond. That's where you start seeing these big holes. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. 2 does feel fully realized, but once you get to 3 and 4, the puzzles are slight, but still annoying, and you don't meet a lot of new characters. And there are signs that there were some development issues along the way. And one more thing to note about the game's production are the voice actors. So, as recently as 2020, production companies are now much more mindful about culturally and racially appropriate casting, where it's like, if there's a black character, we're going to hire a black actor for several good reasons. People were not on that page, obviously, 25 years ago. And this is, this is why this game seems so progressive, because they hired mostly, I believe the term is Latinx, or I'm not sure what the appropriate term, but Hispanic, Mexican-American, Cuban-American. They're hiring culturally and racially appropriate folks for the role. And the main character is played by Tony Plana, who is a Cuban-American actor. And there was a discussion early on in this development, like, should this game, the main character, should he have an accent? And it's interesting to see they went with that. And it's not a joke. It's not a broad Speedy Gonzalez style character. Just like, this is the way this man talks, and they don't play it up for fun. They respect the actor, and they respect the heritage of the character, I guess we can say. It's very great to see in 98.
When they were casting for the role, they actually mentioned that along with Tony, there was another serious contender for acting for Manny, and they were more of a comedic voice actor, comedic actor in general. And the sound director actually mentioned that they really pulled everything they could to really go for Tony. They put in like attractive headshots of Tony and things that kind of make him look cool, just because in comparison, they realize that the authenticity of having a serious sort of presentation of Manny was such a big deal for this.
Yeah, honestly. And I think that the white adventure game playing audience, they were trained to think, okay, Latin American accents, Cheech Marin, hilarious guy. I feel like that is the direction that anyone with that sort of accent was asked to play for at this point in time. But he just sounds like a natural speaking human being, and it does play into his character and the environments of the game. And he actually made a lot of suggestions to Tim Schafer in terms of here's the slang we should use, here's how we should refer to people, here is appropriate exclamations in like if you're in Cuba or if you're in Mexico, things like that. So by casting an appropriate actor, he was actually able to be more authentic in terms of even the script writing.
Yeah. Tony Planet, I mean, carries this game on his shoulders and does so seemingly without breaking a sweat, hitting a whole bunch of tones. And I think that, you know, for everything that he brought to it, if there was worse direction, if they were not willing to listen to his input on how to shape this character and how to, you know, make the dialogue feel a bit more genuine, a lesser creative team would have boxed him out for that. But you can kind of feel that collaboration with the way that he comes through.
They also described him as like a workaholic. He was apparently doing acting jobs at the same time and coming in like, you know, tired and, you know, just willing to just do more and more. So it must have been a wonderful experience working with a guy who was just so eager and just really laying it out so well.
It's almost like video game voice actors, you know, deserve better working conditions and wages and stuff.
Absolutely. And I mean, one thing I noticed about this game is I love Day of the Tentacle, and it is much more cartoony. It wants you to not take it too seriously, but they rely a lot on, you know, impressions in that game. And in this, not so much, I noticed. They could have easily done imitations of a lot of classic film noir actors. Really, it's just Peter Lorre, Chowchilla Charlie, and Sidney Greenstreet as the main villain who we rarely hear or see in this game. So they're not relying too much on, you know, caricature, vocal caricature for shorthand to inform characters, which I like because, you know, Manny could have been a lot broader, Meche could have been a lot broader, and I just like that, again, this is just the world taking itself seriously and the characters taking the world seriously. And as far as release information, so this game was not a flop, like I said earlier. It was a modest hit, but the landscape was changing drastically, and in about six months, it was already really happening right now. Star Wars enthusiasm was cooking. We didn't understand how bad the movies would truly be. But by the spring of 99, LucasArts was like, well, there's a lot of money in making Star Wars games. We're going to make a lot of them. What are adventure games? Get to work on designing this lightsaber. So this was at a unfortunate time for adventure games, not just for the changing state of the industry, but for the fact that LucasArts could make Star Wars games and everyone wanted to talk about Star Wars again. It was not just this obscure thing that dorks remembered and you know, like, hey, let's play Dark Forces, remember Darth Vader? No, there were new movies, Jar Jar was on every Pepsi cup you saw, and it was you know, not a time to be alive. I'll say that was the one aspect of 1999 I didn't enjoy.
If people see the name Lucas and it's not on something called Star Wars, they get real confused, like a rat when you don't turn the lights on. They just start walking in circles, they start eating the carpet, it gets really bad. So you got to make sure that the Lucas and the Star Wars are aligned.
You know, and I don't think I noticed any, I mean, I'm sure there's dialogue I missed, but I didn't really notice any Star Wars or any Indiana Jones references in this game. Maybe Manny talks about selling leather jackets at some point, but again, they're not breaking the fourth wall as they normally did in these games. I feel like that's pretty rare for a LucasArts game to not acknowledge that it's an adventure game.
Yeah, I think the one thing that Tim did mention was that he said, like, oh, at this part time, my writing career, you know, puns were, you know, the idea of, if not puns, wordplay, witty wordplay, where you have sort of these complex jokes that may be a little heavy handed there as far as an adventure game aspect. But there was not referential humor that brought anything as far as dissonance into what this experience was as a total.
Yeah, going into it's so weird because film noir and like naturalistic dialogue are normally so diametrically opposed, but the one thing that naturalistic dialogue is closer to is film noir. It's very far away from, we're gonna go for a very long walk to set up this wordplay or this pun, you know, punchline delivery.
And there's nothing particularly 1998 about the writing or whatever they're referencing in this game. It very much sticks to its own world. Maybe there are a few things I'm forgetting, but I don't really recall them really digging into, like, oh, this is this 1998 thing that's happening, or this thing that's moving in culture right now. It does feel like it has not escaped the 40s or the 50s, wherever, whatever time period this is meant to take place in.
Yeah, no Monica Lewinsky stuff or whatever, no cheap stuff like that.
What was it? Robert Thank Frost God. Was the reference that I remember specifically.
Yeah, I guess Robert Frost. So, I guess you get one of the characters, you get one of their blue garments, but Manny does not say, oh, I'm glad there's not a stain on this, yeah, or something like that, you know? It could have been much worse. Yeah. But yeah, that is basically the production of Grim Fandango. There's a lot to read about it online. There is a great commentary track. It sounded like a very fun time to be at LucasArts working on this project that was Golden Boy Tim Schafer's blank check. And everyone seemed to have a very good time, although they seemed to also be very tired, having worked on this project. I want to talk about the game, how it plays, the puzzles, the story, and all that stuff. But to be fair and to keep this discussion organized, I want to break it down into the good and the bad. And the bad is coming last because I don't want to linger too long on the bad, but I do have issues with this game that I feel, boy, they really make this not fun to play for me.
And that's throughout. Totally valid. It has a lot of artifacts of both the time period, but also just doing something so totally new and really foraying into a space that it's a really hard one. It was a tricky deal all across the board.
Yeah, and we can see why this did not end up being the default adventure game format. This stuck around for a very short period of time. It's really just an evolutionary dead end, and I feel, in terms of the gameplay, a failed experiment. Everything else succeeds in amazing ways. I don't want to sound like I'm down on the game, but how it executes the gameplay, I feel, is not fun. But good things, good times, happy dancing skeletons. So the good, here's my first point. So we talked about this up front. This fully captures the spirit of film noir in a way that no other game really has. At least I feel that personally. Like L.A. Noir, I think people played L.A. Noir much later thinking it's going to be like old-timey black and white melodrama. But no, L.A. Noir was like gritty and realistic, and it was really capturing the James Ellroy take on crime instead of the slightly sanitized black and white crime thriller take on crime. And this evokes it the best, down to smoking and drinking, which I think is very key to making this feel authentic. And it actually does feel shocking to me now that we're seeing less depictions of smoking and drinking, that this is a game ostensibly that, you know, made for families to play. Manny's idle animation is smoking.
Mm-hmm.
That plays in the puzzles. He can drink. There are references to him having gotten drunk. Your best friend in the game is an alcoholic. It has, like, all of those culturally important things to make a crime story seem, apt and appropriate.
This would be forcibly mature rated because of all the gambling references. Like, just flatline ESRB now, you cannot avoid that. So there'd be no way to get around it. But everything else, it really is quite an adult, mature game in a lot of ways that was not typical at all for the time.
The smoking in particular, that was dissonant enough at the time that the original manual had like a little thing that said, you know, kids take note, every character who smokes in this is dead.
Yes. Yeah, actually, no, he's smoking on the cover of the box, too. It's mm-hmm. such a cool image. Like beyond any discussion of noir, this is a very cool game.
God, I could really use
such a sense of
cool. Yeah, I'm already there.
I'm getting one right after this podcast. No, Manny's not vaping. He's not blowing cotton candy fog.
Oh, no, if they had updated it, that would have been amazing.
Out of his skull.
Just instead of doing a double entendre with Meche, he just pulls in a bunch and then blows out like that ship that Gandalf blows. That'll impress her.
We had not invented vaping yet to make smoking less cool. But yeah, to me, and this is someone who has read a lot of these books by a lot of great authors and seen like all of the big noir movies, when I play this, it's not like, oh, you ripped this off. It's like, oh, no, you got it. You understood the assignment, as they say. And also the violence, I feel like, is I wouldn't say shocking, but it's appropriate and unexpected in a game like this where the getting sprouted does seem like a fate worse than death, where there's no answer to what happens when an undead skeleton gets sprouted. And that's the version of murder in this world. And what I found especially interesting is Manny is a very relatable hero, but the final thing you do in the game is kill the villain. It's not an accident. It's just like, okay, how do I murder this man? Because that is the only way to solve this issue. And that feels like a non-LucasArts comedic adventure game thing to do. It's played very seriously.
Yeah, I mean, and also like the hero killing the villain, you know, it's impossible to talk about film noir without talking about the Hays Code too, you know. And
yes,
like if you look at specifically a bunch of the movies that were made, you know, like from the late 30s through to the early 50s, the villain usually didn't die at the end. They had to be carried off by the cops, and usually so did the hero as well, because they had to like portray all of this crime stuff still somehow in this framework of very conventional you know, morality, authority-based morality at the time, too. So having him just straight up, I mean, just ice the two main villains in this, it is actually a little bit dissonant with the with the genre, but it still feels, you know, like a good resolution to this, because what do you do with somebody in a world where they're already dead, and, you know, in a way death is not necessarily like permanent, right?
I thought that was the really interesting aspect of it, because it is all intrinsically tied to, you know, what exactly happens to them when they sprout. And, you know, Tim mentions it, like, you know, I'm not really exactly sure. I guess maybe they get reincarnated, they get pulled back into the, you know, the world. And, you know, it's this sort of rebirth concept that it lessens the violence, but it doesn't lessen the actual violence, the severity of what you're seeing.
Oh, but horror.
Yeah, you know, it's quite menacing and, like, upsetting, especially Lola. Poor Lola. Just done so wrong. And the way that the sprouting connects more to the Day of the Dead than film noir, I think that's like a really important bridge as far as how the violence can be dissonant for that, but actually extremely cohesive as a whole.
Yeah, it's full of, not to linger on this too long, it's full of great body horror, especially when you learn that it's sort of like a zombie attack. You can stop the sprouting if you sever the limb or whatever. And so one character is just a head who basically does a suicide attack to take out a villain. Another character is just a head and an arm that, you know, is still, you know, able to bounce around and help you out. And then later in the game, the villain's hideout is just on a hill full of corpses of people he's disposed of. All the flowers you see are dead bodies, essentially. So, again, it's a very, not to be cute, it's a grim game.
Yeah. No, I mean, and also it works in the classic beat from one of these movies where the main character is, you know, grievously injured and still has to, you know, pull out some kind of miracle, you know, to stop the terrible thing from happening.
It's such a show of confidence, too, when you've been so menaced by sprouting throughout the entire game to see, oh, this guy knows what to do immediately. And then Manny, when he later is able to handle it for himself, it's like this is showing that these characters specifically are a little bit head and shoulders as far as how this world is interacting with them, how they can deal with it.
And one thing about the game is that Tim Schafer wrote all the dialogue himself.
Wild.
So it comes from a singular point of view, a single author's voice. I believe 7,000 lines of dialogue. He describes it as basically bigger than a phone book when it was all printed out. And some of the best writing ever found in an adventure game. This is just, it all sings. Nothing comes off as clumsy. Some of the interactions that I tried out surprised me. Like, oh, there's dialogue for this. Cool. And it's actually pretty clever. And again, no spooky skeleton puns. There's nothing weak like that. It takes itself seriously, and that's what I like, and that helps the player buy into it. So one other good fact about this game, or a good point about this game, is that we love Manny. Manny's great. He's so relatable. And then we follow him through 4 years. So we're seeing Manny in different positions, and that is very interesting to explore. So he starts off as a deadbeat salesman, and then he becomes a pretty swanky casino owner with some, you know, status and power. And then he becomes a fugitive. And then he becomes something else. So we are not just stuck in this one state of being. The character is moving through his life, encountering ups and downs, and that's affecting his state of mind and the people he's encountering as well.
Also his costumes. Wonderful costume changes throughout.
Yes.
Yeah, and just this kind of character arc and seeing a character's point of view and circumstances change so much, that's not a LucasArts thing. Like, there's not really like huge arcs within a particular game itself. This feels more akin to something like a, you know, like a Gabriel Knight to me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, and it does feel like a blank check game for Tim Schafer, because I'm sure in the pitch he's like, okay, this takes place over 4 years. And anyone else saying that at any other point in time would get shot down immediately. They'd say, no, it's going to take place overnight in this one location, and now make the game in 18 months and get out of my face. But no, he was allowed to make it a 3-year production for 4 years of Manny's life. And yeah, I just love all the circumstances he goes through. And the costume changes are just a nice way to make the game visually more exciting. I love that there's nothing cooler than Manny's like white tuxedo that's on the cover of the game. I love running around in that, and he looks great. And then you end up back in your Grim Reaper costume at the end of the game. No spoilers.
are we avoidant of spoilers for this podcast? I just want to.
I don't think.
I've already talked about it.
I don't really think so. Yeah. We talked about a few spoilery things, but sorry. Cool. Go ahead.
The gravitas of the Grim Reaper costume is a little bit undercut by the fact that he's on stilts under there. I love that reveal at the beginning. It's so good.
I always expect, every time I play through the game again, I just assume there is something that is going to go down mechanically. It was some sort of puzzle with the stilts. Never does. It's just sort of when they're needed, they're there for Manny. But such a fun reveal at the beginning of the game.
And like anyone with a bad job, he's still trying to have fun with it, which is what I like about the intro of this game. But yeah, Manny, great character. I don't know if he would be as great if he wasn't voiced by the voice actor they chose. But yeah, one of the strongest adventure game protagonists. And it helped me tolerate a lot of the things I don't like about this game. So to move on past Manny, let's talk about the world. So the rules of the world are very interesting and unique and very well developed. You can tell Schaefer thought a lot about how things would function in this world. And that's why I feel like we can have a Grim Fandango movie or a Grim Fandango TV series. Now, this might sound crazy, but they made a Costume Quest cartoon about a decade after that game came out. I say if that can happen, let's make a Grim Fandango series. Not even about Manny. Like, there are so many more stories that can be told through the lens of the Department of Death and other things in the world that are happening that are barely touched on in this game.
This is a game that I would have loved to see between the years. Nothing too elaborate, but the idea of, like, a comic book style, a few pages of something that has gone down. It could have really helped get some background details that I felt ultimately were missing. It's so cohesive. Like, it feels... Nothing feels like, oh, I don't know how that works and I'm confused by it. There's like a few aspects of it that like you just want to know more about that world. And that's really the best place to be in when you're kind of creating content in a space where if everything about it is so interesting and feels like it's part of it, read it, you know, the people that experience it are always going to assume that you know what you're doing, even if you maybe don't to the most extent. And it's such a fun opportunity to see where it could be.
I mean, it would really lend itself well to an animated series kind of thing, just because there's a lot of focus on like the city and civilizational aspects of it. This is a really surreal world too, you know, like the petrified forest, you know, what's going on at the bottom of the ocean, you know, all those particular kind of things. It feels like there's a lot to explore there, even just pulling from, you know, other aspects of the mythology that, you know, were, you know, maybe considered, but not ultimately used for this.
Yeah, that's probably the issue that I would be worried about trying to create a new version or new adaptation of it. It's just authenticity and making sure that there isn't stepping on toes of any sort of cultural. It's a really tricky space to navigate anymore. And I think Grim Fandango is an example of it doing superlatively, but trying to do a new work in that space, that would be a lot of familiar problems going in that space.
Yeah, definitely. But I still say that if, Disney owns this, Disney last year spent, I don't know, $80 million making a Willow TV series that they immediately threw in the trash. Spend 10 on this. I dare you, Disney. I dare you. But yeah, like, this is such a great world. And because it's a 12-hour game, we can only learn so much about it and the people in it. So, I don't know. There's more here to explore. Maybe comic book, maybe novel, maybe TV series. Tim Schafer, get the rights back. Just like, hey, Ron Gilbert got the rights back to Monkey Island, and that was a great, great sequel. So who knows? I'm now telling game developers what to do, which is the point of Retronauts.
We all want the Grimmer Fandango to come out someday.
And what Bob says on our podcast is legally binding.
Absolutely. Please consult your local lawyer. So the graphics in this game have they've aged fairly well, I would say. The choice to go with these paper mache looking skeleton figures was a good one. I mean, if you're used to what modern games look like, obviously you can literally see the seams in every character. Anything that's not a skeleton looks disgusting. I love Glottis, but man, that is a rough 3D model that eventually will grow on you. But he's not ready for polygons, Glottis.
All of the demons, I think that is just a real missed opportunity, and it is the thing that has aged worse. These could be cool and could be interesting, but every time you're on the screens, you have to think, is that a toenail fungus goblin? Is that going to be in a commercial where he lifts it up like a hinge and it scars me for life?
Pneumatic tube worker is definitely one of the weaker as far as any particular visual asset.
He definitely lives under a toenail, and I'm glad we don't see him go home and recreate that commercial. But yeah, I mean, so yeah, the polygons, it was such a smart idea. They weren't ready to render people yet. These are such iconic, great designs. I love how all the characters look. Very easy to make your own Manny at home, I assume. And, you know, they're from a certain point in time, but I do have a lot of nostalgia for these pre-rendered graphics. And I think, like you said, Cole, given the Art Deco style, they were given an achievable level of complexity to meet with their technology.
Well, the Art Deco stuff is interesting to think about because all of that, you know, they're pre-rendered background. So they actually had, you know, quite they could model whatever they really wanted. Those are going to be, you know, finalized as images, image data, and movie data. So they really, they made the best of that. And that stuff, I think that was maybe upscaled or whatever they did for the remastered. It definitely felt very strong and that was very nicely done. But the work that they put into those rendered scenes, really, really dramatic. And then integrating them with the 3D action of the game overlaid on top. There's so much commentary about the experiences of trying to make a particular scene, of trying to integrate them and the issues that cause. No end of effort and really talented, you know, hard work going into making that all possible.
I don't want to move off of the art direction without at least addressing how amazing it is the way that they represent the world of the living in this game.
Yes, thank you, Cole. Yeah. Please discuss that.
That super eerie collage, everything is a magazine cutout. When you try to interact with the living people, like their facial features get mixed up and all you hear is like a scream. That is so chilling. It is one of the most horrific things I have seen in a non-horror game, and a very good decision. And I want to hear your thoughts on that, Everdrain.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's actually exact scene. I've been asked if that's been an inspiration, and it's not like the most like forefront one, but absolutely the idea of the wrongness that any sort of photo images, like the collage nature of it. They mentioned that the specific trick is to have facial features flipped upside down. Mm-hmm. And that's like so it's such a simple thing, but it's so, it's so unpleasant. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's a definitely there. I mean, I would love to play an entire game directly in that space.
The closest you're going to get, I was going to bring this, like if you like that style, a series of games that does use that very well is the Cat Lady Resolution, Lorelei, the most recent one, Burnhouse Lane, indie horror games that will throw in like a mixed media kind of approach. That would be, if you're looking for that, that's where that is.
Oh, that's a great recommendation. I'm going to have to check those out.
Yeah, I mean, it's only one screen of the game, but it's so visually iconic. It's so striking. It's so eerie that I wish you had a reason to go back into the land of the living for other puzzles. It felt like they had some bigger idea, but even just that brief glimpse of what it actually looks like to the undead is kind of enough to add a lot more mystery to the game. Like, oh, there's a lot more going on here that they're not showing me.
It's also a nice way to kind of make it ephemeral as well. It's not important. It's all the years, all the time that you're playing, you're actually on the Day of the Dead, and you know, the rest of the people of the Land of the Dead are going back in remembrance, but Manny is not. Manny does not have a reason to go back, and that's the idea that for Manny, at least, that you know, the driver of the narrative, the Land of the Living has nothing left for him. I think that's a really important point that they return to repeatedly, and they do a great job with that. Just having it as a tiny little vignette, that's so impressive.
So we're going over the good points. Is there anything else we want to talk about before we move on to the bad points of Grim Fandango?
Yes. So something, we talk about it being an early 3D implementation and sort of a lot of its designs and puzzles. So, you know, to some negativity, reflect that. But I did want to just bring up as a part, you know, good and bad, the fact that the 3D, the way they use the 3D spaces, if they might not always be the most intuitive, but they are a very interesting direct interaction between the player, items, and the world space itself. And that's something that physicality of things having a real sense of place inside the scenes, that's something you really did not get so much in adventure games before that point, before you went to 3D spaces. It's, you know, you'd have animation principles, and, you know, some might say that's stronger, but for actually figuring out a puzzle, if it's really well integrated into the physicality of a scene, that is essentially a signpost. And, you know, I think one of the puzzles that I had a good time with, as far as understanding it very quickly, what was necessary, maybe not being able to actually pull it off all that well, was like the forklift puzzle. The idea of knowing, okay, I know, because, you know, the physicality of this immediately makes it obvious what I'm trying to do. I wish it was a little bit easier to pull off.
Yes.
But it's so clear, and that, you know, that was them using the 3D spaces really well. Another, like the burning beaver puzzle, it's like, it's only possible if you have these sort of 3D physicality, you can throw a bone and have them chase after it. Another implementation that will quickly go into the next section of this podcast, though.
So, yes, I'm glad you brought up, we're going to segue into the controls and what they mean for an adventure game. So, yes, remastered, the tank controls are optional. If you want to get that special achievement to play through the entire game with tank controls and make Tim Schafer happy, you can always do that, but I don't recommend it. But my main issue is it's really a one verb game, and that cuts down on the potential amount of possible puzzles in the game, leaving us with what I feel are some kind of annoying ones. So, they're trying to be forward thinking, but I also think they're shooting themselves in the foot, because a lot of these things they're getting rid of, I think, are essential, like more verbs in a UI. So they're trying to make this more immersive because, you know, you're in a 3D world. How do you be more immersive? We'll get rid of the UI, and when you see interactables on the screen, Manny will tilt his head towards them instead of the game highlighting them in some artificial way. And I found that this causes a lot of problems, even when I knew what to do, because the game has a real issue with putting two things too close together. And it's all about moving Manny to the exact right space. And even then, it's not clear if he's not big enough on the screen. Like, am I looking at the book on the table, or am I looking at the people sitting at the table? There were so many ways where that element of the interface got in the way with me wanting to do what I wanted to do.
I think there's a commentary note that's like, I don't know if you noticed, but there's no UI in this game. And yes. I think everyone notices that very, very quickly.
Yeah.
The big killer for me, the one that always gets me whenever I play through the game again, is definitely the inventory. Is just, it's very noble what is trying to be done with the inventory, but just not being able to see all your items, having to scroll through them, having to figure out, like, do I have to go left or right to be the fastest to get to the item I actually want to use, and hey, holding that in your head. It's like, mm-hmm. Whatever you last picked up will be on the left. So it's,
yeah,
it's rough. And it's, to their credit, yeah, they work with it. They limit how many items in your inventory. But there are instances where you can have multiple of the same, where it's like you might want a few as backup with balloons or bread or whatever. And it's they let you really fill up your inventory with just those items. And then it's like scrolling through five dead worm balloons to get to where you need to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was... go ahead, Cole.
My kingdom for a grid, an inventory grid to see everything there. One thing that's taken away, too, when you have this, you know, reaching into his pocket kind of inventory thing, there's no item combination, you know, reduces the complexity and, you know, the opacity of these puzzles, you know, is a problem. I don't know that doing item combinations to mix things up would have helped that. But I think that everybody notices the lack of inventory just because of the compromises that were made.
Yeah, there's one item combination that's putting the hand into the grinder. And that's they mention on the commentary specifically because it's like, we don't do this ever. This is the only time we do in the game to kind of simplify things. And it might have been really hard to understand this was a thing to do at all. And yes, when you take that out completely, the notion of trying to implement that, it's hard to go back and try to pull that in. The other aspect was that these games, there's a lot, if you actually go for them, there's a number of like, oh, you have an item out and you interact with somebody. But the slowness of going into your inventory, pulling out an item, having it come out with the animation, like the scythe, I wanted to have my scythe out a lot just to see what people would say, but the animation of pulling it out and to interact with anything else, you have to put it back. That's so slow and cumbersome. You lose out on trying. When, like in almost any adventure game, I'd pick up every item, put it on the character and see what they say. You lose that intrinsic sort of exploration space. You have to be very purposeful in Grim Fandango.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is a very naive thinking about 3D graphics, which we can't blame them because they were new and people were entertained by certain elements of the 3D world where they're like, oh, it's a 3D world. We're not just going to have a menu with your items. He's going to pull them out of his coat. Just sort of like the idea of the future in 98 was like, you're going to put on your VR headset and get in a virtual line at the virtual store and put the virtual thing in your virtual basket. Like, no, make it as simple as possible. We don't care about immersion that much.
No.
And it's sort of like why, like you said, Everdrade, a lot of these animations take so long to play out. Like Manny getting into things, Manny climbing down from things. Oh, it's like... The idea in 98 was like, isn't it cool? You can see this polygonal character doing things. It's sort of like when you watch an old cartoon from 1929. It's like, well, this duck is just walking down the street singing a song. Oh, I'm bored. but people in theaters are like, the duck is moving.
I mean, it's rubber hose at that point. It's so good. I do want to say what it was the very last scene of the game, literally the last scene. I'm noticing, oh, I can take out the sprout gun and put it back while running. So, like, that's actually, it's a, I don't know how many items are like that, but, like, definitely not the scythe. The scythe, you have to stop, pull it up, get that sucker out there. But the gun itself, like, I don't know if they expected to have more usage of the gun in, like, an action sequence where, like, while he's moving, that gun needs to pop out. But they absolutely had the capability to integrate the animations with other movement animations as well. And I was just wondering, like, I wonder how deep that goes. I kind of want to go back and kind of see what that space is, what they actually pulled off.
Yeah. It's thinking about this again too. So like one thing that you don't fix by adding in the point and click controls on this is the fact that the lack of verbs, you know, really does go bone deep on this one, which is, you know, you've got to figure out basically just adds more steps to everything, more little irritations, and it's less about trying to discern or trying to find an ingenious solution to what's in front of you, and more about figuring out how to surmount just this seemingly arbitrary friction that is put in front of you. And I think that just ups the irritation without getting an awful lot in return.
There's also, you know, there's three interactions you can look, you can utilize, and you can pick up. And utilize and pick up often share the same action. They are not perfectly good at making sure there's something distinct and unique for every single one, which is kind of, at some point, I was trying to do all three for everything. Then I was like, well, if I can use it, then it's probably automatically going to pick it up if I need to. But you don't know what you're missing. And the idea of a player wanting to engage with the world as much as possible, but kind of giving up because they don't feel like the tedium is going to make it worth it. That's something you got to be very careful with throughout, any game design.
And there might have been a hint in the bark that you would have gotten by trying to do that, that once you pick it up or once you use it, you can't go back and get that hint again.
I wonder so much how many items are like, if you had this, you know, whipped out when you interacted with any number of NPCs, oh yeah, that's the next step. Like if you had the ticket stub printer for the cat races, I'll talk about the cat race. That one always gets me. If you had that whipped out in like every scene and talked to every person, like maybe they would string you along to the point to like as much as you needed, but you're not going to do that. You're going to miss it almost certainly.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the interface, but I feel that the puzzle design goes even deeper beyond that. I mean, the puzzles are constrained by the one verb, but I feel that Ron Gilbert is not dead, so he's rolling in his bed when people play this game, because this just violates so many Ron Gilbert rules I have ingrained in my brain, in that the signposting in Grim Fandango is so bad. And I mean, because it's a singular vision of one person, the dialogue is great. It's all like from one perspective. But I think because of that, he's too close to the game to understand that players aren't understanding what they need to do and why they need to do it. So if you're an adventure game player, when you're in a new area, you're like, I'll talk to everybody, expend all the dialogue, and then I'll see what happens next. And if you do that in Grim Fandango, you're going to just absorb all the dialogue. You won't be sure what's flavor text and what is puzzle relevant text. And then that dialogue will be gone from the game forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But beyond that, there are simple things where I always had the question, like, why does Manny want to do this? What are his reasons for doing this? Because there are never any statements that would have helped, like Manny saying, oh, if only I could blank, or, oh, I need something that can blank. Like those little nudges would help you stay on track. And Everdrade, we were talking over Discord and you were saying, you know, something as simple as a little notebook Manny with objectives would help. I mean, he's sort of playing a detective in a way, and I feel like that would keep me on track. But for the most part, my major gripe is that the puzzle relevant text does not stay existent in the world. It just goes away, and you are left wandering and pretty helpless, and there's no hint system or anything.
I think I mentioned a little black book for him to pull out, put down, jot down details, almost doodle, whatever. That sort of, and another source for, you know, if there's anything important in dialogue, they do that. Manny maybe picked up on it and then has some sort of thoughts as well. I love the notion. This is a, sometimes you see this concept as a diary, sometimes it's like a scrapbook sort of thing. But the idea that, I think in the space, Manny is represented as a very competent, you know, they show him as a kind of a failure of the Department of the Dead, but that's not his fault. He's really trying his best. And then you see him every year. He's so competent. He rises to, you know, the owner of the casino. He rises to being a captain. He's a competent dude. He could absolutely have this sort of idea of, you know, this is my thoughts. This is, you know, this is what I noted. You can get away with that. And that sort of intrinsic, really flavorful from the character perspective, signposting, so good and so helpful. That's like the best idea of a hint system, where you actually, they're, what they say can be incredibly funny, but really to the point. You get a little bit of that with the inventory system. You get a little bit of that rarely, because most items are kind of throwaway as far as the commentary. Sometimes they string you along, but the signposting is a roughie.
Yeah. It's a real problem.
And, you know, and I wonder if that idea, if you proposed it at the time, based on them wanting to really put you into Manny's shoes, was there an assumption that you as the player were writing stuff down? And, you know, why would Manny be writing the stuff down at the same time, too?
Yeah.
You know, so much of the, you know, signposting, you know, the hints are things that you need to observe in the game that are not tied to a dialogue event, really. And that's a thing that, like, you know, sunk Riven, right? Another, you know, just to pull another adventure game roughly from the same time. Just the problem you're talking about with hint stuff going away, I want to give like an example for anybody who hasn't played this but wants an idea. You're talking to a clown who is tying balloon animals. And there is what you think is a fun little joke about the fact that he's doing it with bony hands, that like, oh, the balloon would pop when he's trying to do this, right? He's got these sharp little bones, and you shout bang and it pops. The game is expecting you not to focus on how funny it is that you made this clown mess up. It's expecting you to notice that when that happens, like the balloon popping in particular makes pigeons scatter. Right. And then you have to remember that and then think, OK, there are pigeons that need to scatter later. When I get to that, I need to make sure that I, bring up balloon up there in order to try that. You cannot do the bang and make him pop the balloon again. That dialogue goes away. And this gets compounded when you have hints that are given in chapter one. And you have to remember that it is used two or three chapters later.
Yeah, something as easy as, you know, looking at the balloon saying, oh man, pigeons really hate when these pop, or something. You know, yeah. I'm not an adventure game designer. Tim Schafer could think of something more clever to write. But yeah, it's relying on the player a lot. And I mean, I think in 98, they were still thinking, well, you were an adventure game player in 98. What else are you going to do with your life? Start writing things down. And also, buy the hint book or call the 1-900 Star Wars or whatever. Yeah. Or go online if you're stuck. But I feel like much later in life, Ron Gilbert discovered, we want to keep you in the game as much as possible. So here's a hint system in the game, because if you leave the game, you could be gone forever. You could just say, screw this, I'm watching Netflix or whatever. But obviously, there was fewer forms of entertainment in 98. But yeah, the signposting is bad. And I also think like some puzzles have no logic. The puzzles were thought of first, but not like how to justify them within the game. One of them I'm thinking of, not to get too specific, is you are trapped in this area and you need to get a gun. And in order to get a gun, you have to trade a character a stocking for the gun. But there is never any indication that this is a possible transaction that could be made. The guy's never like, oh, I need something silk and stretchy. There's nothing like that
actually,
in the dialogue.
There actually is, but you can miss it, and it's never, you can never go back to it or try it again. If you talk,
that's probably
to
what happened to
me. You talk to him, he's like, hey, would you like to trade anything? The very first time you go through the dialogue menu, it's like a list of items that you could trade for where a silk stocking is mentioned. But if you do any other option, it'll pull you out. It was like, no, you know, you did your selection and it won't go back to it. So like, you'll just miss it totally and you'll never get that line again.
That is like a very tiny hint. But even if you get that, you have to be aware that a character in the game is wearing stockings.
Oh, yeah.
And that is hard to read on these skeleton characters. And then Like with a lot of puzzles in this game, because there is a lack of verbs, they have to get inventive for the kind of puzzles they can make, and a lot of them are timing-based, which should never happen in an adventure game, and Tim Schafer was really obsessed with those in Full Throttle as well, so there's always the question, like, am I doing the right thing, or am I doing the right thing at the wrong time, or am I just doing the wrong thing?
The timing puzzles in this one are delayed as well, almost all of them. It's not, you're not doing it when you need to, it's like, there's an animation that has to play, you have to know the length of the animation and do it right in time with the world event.
It's also bugged in the port. There's like it's dependent on VSync sometimes too, so like you might just like, why in the world is this so hard, what is this? It's a technical issue.
Again, because of the one verb solution in this game, the just to do verb, they have to do what Full Throttle also did, which is like, well, you don't have a really big inventory, you can't really combine items in this game, and you have one verb, so we're going to give you all of these complex machines with their own controls to play with, and these just frustrated the hell out of me. Any puzzle involving Manny has to operate something in order to achieve a goal, like the, I mean, in theory, I like the forklift on the elevator, but it took me about 8 tries to actually jam it in the right spot. And again, I was like, I have to watch a video of this on YouTube to make sure I'm doing this, and that should not be the case. Some more I can think of is like when you have to tangle the ship up in its two anchors, it's never clear like what your goal is, and it takes so long because when Manny moves the ship, you get basically a cutscene of where the ship currently is and where the anchors currently are. It's just, it takes so long, it's irritating. And then the pneumatic tube system, one of the early puzzles in the game, that is one of a few puzzles in this game where you have to go through the initial steps if you fail. So if you fail this, you have to go get the balloons from the mime again, you have to fill the balloons again, you have to put them in the tube again. It happened to me because I forgot to turn the deadbolt the guy was cleaning.
Exactly the same. I did it again this playthrough too.
Yep.
I love Chipito. Chipito is the one that actually, it sticks out to me every time. I know instinctually when I go into the screen that's on the bottom on the ocean floor, make a save. Make a save. So like the first time Chipito comes through, you can talk to him. If you miss Chipito when he walks through the scene, he takes like at least like, what, like 2 minutes to walk in a big circle in the background to finally get back. And it's so, and there's so little on that screen. There's maybe like 40 seconds worth of content to kind of like talk to Gladys, look at the sea, like look at the pearl, and that's it. And if you, not only do you have to talk to him, if you, there's an option to make you walk around with them to waste the full 2 minutes, which has a really fun, so, you know, Gladys sings a bit, which is cool, but it's almost like willfully knowing people are going to waste their time pretty badly here in a lot of ways they'll likely play it.
Yeah, with that character, I let him pass by me, and I thought, like, did I screw up? Do I have to do something on the screen? And then, like, you know, I had to read a hint and say, you know, it said, no, just wait for him to come back. And I thought, like, what am I learning from this interaction? The same thing with having to spray the beavers again. Like, what did this teach me failing? Because an adventure game should not be about performance. It should be like, if I know how to do the puzzle, I should just be able to do it. There should not be timing involved. I should not have to run a wheelbarrow over hoses in order to like sync up different pumps on this big machine. I hate all of the machine puzzles. They're so frustrating. The signpost puzzle in the forest, very deceptive. In general, I think a lot of people, when they play through this game, they might just stop at the Petrified Forest because it is a bunch of the worst kind of puzzles in this game and nobody to talk to. And it is a big, like, hurdle to get over before you get to the cool Rubikava part of this game.
It's a bummer because, like, that signpost puzzle, they did it once and then they did it again at the end of the game, just with a different object.
Yes, yes. And I forgot about that, yeah.
The beaver, the burning beaver puzzle is, like, the classic. I remember that in the end of year two. Those are, like, the big ones that everybody stopped at. It's like, what, you know, this is my experience with the game that kind of turns me off. And those are rough ones. And I always think about, like, I love Gladys. I love every time Gladys is on this game. If Gladys was on every screen and just waggled his ears whenever you're kind of on the right pathway, I would love this game probably 5 times more than I do. It's just Gladys, even if Gladys is just doing the simplest sort of commentary of signposting, I think, or whatever, you know, any character on the screen, just having a little bit more to it. There's so much that could be done. You know, even if it's just Manny making commentary on it. And I really wonder if there is an intention for it. Obviously, the head tracking, there's this notion that things need to be pointed out. There needs to be signposting, but the mechanical sort of aspect of timing of like, oh, I just missed it. I was too early. I was too late. There's all these little things that could be implemented with Manny making it easier for the player to understand what they're even engaging with.
And I know that Tim Schafer, these are kind of trends in his game design. And I know Psychonauts 2 is very good, but I hear that Broken Age has similar issues with signposting. I think like he just has a different philosophy from his former boss when it comes to what an adventure game should be. And Tim Schafer was very nice to write the afterword of my book, so thank you, Tim. Mm-hmm. But your puzzles, sometimes they really piss me off.
In the commentary, he's like, I apologize. I don't know how you... This worked in my head. He literally says that at least twice that I can remember in the commentary. He's like, this made sense in my head, and we put it in, and people told me it didn't really, and I should have listened. And, at least, you know, you do... I think the big one, I remember it specifically for the chain... the crane chain that you then have on the conveyor belt. What always gets me, I forgot it again this playthrough, you have to make the chain go backwards like twice, and that'll wrap around the anchor, and then you can use... It's like, why would you ever think to do that? Like, what purpose would you want to do that at all? Why would you try to pull the chain away? You wanted to get there in the first place so you could have this interaction. It's like, you're actively going away from the solving of the puzzle for the solving of another puzzle. And that's really dangerous if you do not have signposting.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are two puzzles in this game that require outside chain knowledge that I simply don't have.
Assuming a lot of knowledge of chain mechanics on this one.
Yes. I've never really dealt with chains very often in my life, but it's like, well, this is how two chains wrap around each other. This is how a chain wraps around itself. It just... Yeah, these puzzles are a bummer. Were there any particularly bad puzzles that stood out to you? Like, for the most part, when, like, very few puzzles in this game are satisfying to me. If I would stumble across a solution, I would think, that's it? And I feel like we were too late in adventure game design to still be saying that out loud. And then all the very mechanical ones were annoying. And that's why I feel like... revisiting this world could be beneficial to make a more playable game. And my own advice is, if you are getting frustrated, don't stop playing. Don't try to figure it out yourself. Just use a walkthrough, because the most valuable thing in Grim Fandango is the dialogue and the story and the world and the music, which we didn't mention yet, by Peter McConnell. Amazing soundtrack. Like, there's so much music. It's all so great. On the commentary, he talks about, like, here's a specific instrument we used, and just he is, like, he knows so much about the world of jazz, too, that it's very authentic. But my ideal Grim Fandango experience is, don't even, like, watch a Let's Play, because it's fun to still have control of Manny and the dialogue and everything, but, like, just absorb the best elements of the game. So any other negative qualities? Let's end on a bad note. Yeah. Any other negative qualities I didn't mention? I mean, like I said before, the pre-rendered graphics are very of their time and, you know, very cool. This is a very cool game, but also they're in love with this idea. So you're running, especially in Rubikava, let's run under that blimp 1,000 times. Even though they give you a few shortcuts, but nearly not enough. And it's like, oh, my kingdom for fast travel in this game.
Yeah. So related to the pre-render background stuff, so much of this feels empty, not just from a, you know, like, hey, where are the people kind of deal. But also just from like a density of detail, things to observe, things to pick up, things to, you know, interact with and try, you know, the pre-rendered cinematic camera angles, you know, those kind of exist athwart the previous shot composition that they had, where it was very intentional that when you're in this location, we are showing you everything that is relevant about it in this one screen that you're going to see. Maybe you go left, right, deeper or out, but like pretty much everything is going to be there. And the spaces are too cavernous for them to do what they sometimes do, which is the thing that you are looking for is actually off in the corner of this particular place. Actually finding new screens within a particular space, it does end up being like a weird little form of pixel hunting is what I sometimes feel, especially again when you get into chapter 3 where you're dealing with caves. You run into that a little bit with, you know, the petrified forest as well. I think it is just this growing pain of them trying to figure out how to make these Resident Evil camera angles work for an interaction model that is still, I think, kind of geared toward their strengths of doing like really good just screen composition for finding and interacting and playing with things.
Yeah, you're totally right. Outside of the design of the puzzles, I was stuck most of the time because I didn't know room existed. And that yeah. is the case for small spaces and big spaces. Like small spaces, I forgot that there's a little alcove in the tattooist's area where his bed is and the refrigerator is. Like it's very easy to miss. And then in larger spaces, because sometimes you'll like move Manny to one corner of the screen and another corner of the screen is like, well, I can't go that way. So you assume some other dark corner of the screen will lead you nowhere, so you don't try it. But it's like, no, there's a whole other room with people you can talk to and valuable items. Yeah. So I'm thinking of like Final Fantasy VII does an inelegant thing of you hit the select button, it shows you all of the exits on the screen. And that's like super superficial, not elegant in any way, but it was helpful in a time where they weren't always thinking of being practical when designing these very beautiful backgrounds.
Yeah, I absolutely think some sort of vignette, some sort of, if they glow slightly, something that gives you a heads up on where exactly room entrances are. Also with item, like interactive items, I know the head tracking was a really pivotal, very cool thing to see implemented, but having some means, if you don't feel like you know, if you have to be pulled out of the world, it's best to be thought about and then, you know, helped with than maligned by it. And that's really preventing the maligning of people, and, you know, bridging that gap is so important in design. I think the puzzle design, or the density, playing the game with commentary helps a lot with the density. The idea that, like, well, you're on these screens, you know, when you actually play the game, there might not be a whole lot going on, but almost every single one has an extended sort of conversation about, oh, the blimp. You know, the fact that there's something there instead of nothing for the blimp scene, that helps a lot. And I would say Grim Fandango really gets supported by that commentary very well. Like I was thinking, you know, this is a game that I always classically thought, you know, because of the issues, I love the cohesion, I love the tone, the aesthetic. You know, this is maybe like an 8 out of 10 for me. I really enjoy it, but there's, you know, the mechanical aspect of it, but the commentary included, it brings it up to like a 9 out of 10 for me as far as the hearing, oh yeah, this scene used to be a little different and we cut a lot out. That makes sense. And you suddenly, like, when you realize and you hear somebody laughing about the experience, like, oh yeah, this scene, I deleted that and you had to redo it over 2 weeks. You know, hearing that, it's like you have such a more nostalgic, homey feel for playing through the experience that it really adds a lot. It doesn't, you know, it still has a lot of deficiencies. And it's not really like a fair thing to say. It changes the game experience, you know, tremendously. But it's very interesting. And there's so much good intention in Grim Fandango that you can kind of understand, you can realize what they're going for. But hearing someone actually say, like, we tried, and we might not have been super successful, but we did try, it was worthwhile, this could have only happened with us working, you know, this is the product of us all working in this time and doing our best. Just hearing that from them realized is a huge shifter of the way you perceive the game as a whole.
Yeah. It is one of the better documented games. I think that, you know, Double Fine, you know, just the Tim Schafer in particular has been really good about being out of the forefront of, you know, kind of in these remakes, kind of putting in, you know, a little bit of historical documentation to give that perspective, to not make this entirely a negative observation. I just want to leave off on like an admonition for the player. If you're going to be trying this, no, don't worry, it's not you. The puzzle sequencing and like the complexity is actually all over the place. Like there's no real difficulty curve to this. It's very jagged. Yeah, yeah. So like I like the you know, mixing the chemicals for the letter sorter thing. That's a cool puzzle. That is not the first major puzzle that you put in for your game, right?
No,
you know, it is going to be a wall, and then you're going to run into a bunch of other stuff that's like much more simple. Like expect something to be very uneven in terms of complexity. Don't feel like that is a shortcoming that you're bringing to this.
Oh, it's so funny thinking about the puzzle of, you know, getting Glottis's heart and putting it back in. That is the most simple. You walk to the screen, you kind of like, you do a bone in the web, you know, there's really, really kind of immediate and obvious. And then the surrounding puzzles in the petrified forest, they just kick your ass as far as trying to figure out what the heck they want. When that one was so obvious, and you're like, man, I wish the entire game was just a little bit more straightforward and intuitive. And, you know, that's, absolutely right. It is not the player's fault. They, you know, Tim, the devs, they acknowledge the sort of issues that went into it. And there was like arguments. I do want to mention Leslie. I believe she was a producer sort of on the game. She was tasked with essentially making sure things were on time. You know, saying, oh, this needs to be cut. This can't possibly, you know, we can't do this. Really tried her best, clearly, from the, you know, trying to rein things in. And like the she's like, well, we had to get rid of the beavers, you know, the beavers, there's no way, no one knew what was going on with it, we had to take it out. But Tim would do this thing where he'd get a napkin and he'd draw the little beaver on it, then he'd hold it up and go, don't cut me, Leslie, I'm a bee, I just want to be in the game. And it's so hard to cut something like that, and it's just so hard. But this woman was trying. She was also the character of the coat check lady was based on her, and this lady that is trying her best with a lot of very interesting characters, and you know, doing has a job to do, you know, many of the characters of Grim Fandango. Just a beautiful kind of connector to the entire experience of working on a game with Tim. I have to imagine.
And she was right. Yeah.
The commentary is great. It's not just Tim Schafer's perspective. You hear this perspective of like modelers and the musician and Tim, and you hear about experiences with voice actors and executives and things like that. So it is very valuable from like every perspective. And I also will agree with Cole in that like the main thing to go into this thinking is it's not your fault, because every time I got stuck in the game, this happens with adventure games, like if I see the solution, sometimes I'll feel bad, like, oh, I should have plugged away at this a little bit longer, you know, I would have figured it out, or I was stupid to not think of this. But with Grim Fandango, it was always like, I didn't know this character wanted this, I didn't know this was an item I could pick up, I didn't know this room existed, I'm sure I heard this character say that 20 minutes ago, but she won't say it again. So yeah, it just... They weren't as focused on that as they were about trying to innovate other aspects of the adventure game. And I think puzzle design was left by the wayside a bit in terms of just this epic experience with 3D graphics and, you know, this new world. But I guess final thoughts. I've said a lot about this game. And again, it's totally worth playing through. Nothing is like this. To me, and I'm not trying to speak for my guests here, playing the game is the worst part of it. But it should still be experienced, and please steamroll through the puzzles just to experience the world, the dialogue, the characters, the music. That is worth the putting up with the bad puzzles. And that's all I'll say about Grim Fandango to close out here. Everdrade, new guest, what are your final thoughts on Grim Fandango?
Oh, thank goodness for mouse controls. I was actually dreading, you know, this is a game that I have played through in the past, and it was hard for me to come back to. And I, you know, realizing that there is mouse controls, and even with the familiarity with the puzzles, even with knowing like kind of what you have to do, it's amazing. Like in some adventure games, you come back years later and it's like, yeah, okay, I get it. You pretty much know exactly what you plow along just from that previous experience. Grim Fandango, no. There is some stuff that is intuitive. You instantly calls back, but so many things of like these little, well, this was a double interaction. It does add up. It's rough, but with the mouse controls, with the commentary, and with the soundtrack is so good they remastered it. It is a really delightful experience. If you ever had a bad time in the past with Grim Fandango, I'd actually recommend trying the remaster, just giving it one more go. Maybe it's not going to like be very ready to get that walkthrough out there. Be ready to like get those points out for sure. The moment you start feeling like, am I kind of stuck? I don't know what to do. You are. You don't know what to do. You don't know to send the pigeons do whatever they have to do. You don't know to throw the dog tags on the guy. Whatever. It's fine. You'll find the walkthrough, get it done, and just get to the end of the game and see all the character writing. This is a game that the characters just shine. The voice acting, this is a game that has limited numbers of items, limited number of characters overall compared to most adventure games, but the amount of attention to each is really, really stellar. Enjoy, soak it in, but don't let it frustrate you away again. Do what you gotta do.
It sucks because I really wish this game was easier to recommend. I wish it wasn't, and I wish it was uncomplicated to say like, hey, go and dig into this, because when you're saying the worst thing about this game is the game, you're kind of arguing from a back foot, right? You're fighting uphill, you know. I think
it's a great game. Don't play it.
Yeah,
please.
Yeah. But I agree with Bob. You know, this is not one of those ones where you just want to read a wiki or watch a let's play. You know, there's joy in exploring this world and talking with people, having the expression of picking the dialogue, you know, having the dialogue choices, having the you know, the surprise of, you know, just, okay, I already picked that, what is the next thing that is, you know, that is in that line. There's a lot of excellent craft in there for that. I think that what I would say is, if you're approaching this, you know, do not be afraid to go to like Universal Hint System to help smooth that out. Just basically, they probably should have put a hint system in with this for the remaster would probably be ideal in order to, you know, smooth you through. But like, I would say don't let the game get in the way of itself with some of its misguided puzzles. You know, rely on these on these external supports, you know, to, you know, to smooth that out. Things that are external to the actual design of the game are actually pretty crucial to the experience of getting through this. And, you know, if you're a completionist, if you're some kind of purist, leave that at the door. That's weird. You know, don't let that deny you the joy of at least seeing the way the story, you know, comes together.
I never brought it up, but the pigeons and the vultures with human heads, my God, what a wonderfully creepy additions to this game. I wish they had more
flying spiders, flaming beavers. This game has it all. But that has been another episode of Retronauts, and that is the end of our LucasArts miniseries. And it's been a fun 4 years. We'll cover more adventure games, of course. It was very a loosely defined miniseries. But most importantly, please buy my book, the Boss Fight Books volume about Day of the Tentacle, available wherever you buy books. And it's about a Tim Schafer adventure game I like a lot more than this, but I like the writing a lot more in this game. It's complicated, like we said up front and at the end here. But yeah, this has been Retronauts. Find us on Twitter at Retronauts, and we are supported by all of the great fans out there at patreon.com/retronauts. You want to sign up there for $5 a month to get all these episodes ahead of time, and also access to 2 full-length bonus episodes every month. And we've been doing those since the very beginning of 2020, so I dare say there's almost 100 full-length episodes that you haven't heard if you're not a patron at patreon.com/retronauts. And there is also a weekly column and podcast by Diamond Flight included at that $5 tier. It is a great value, and it also helps support everything we do for Retronauts. And thanks to our guests for being on. Let's talk about who they are and where we can find them before I mention my other things. Everdrade, new guest on the show, where can we find you if you want to be found?
I generally am reclusive, so I'd say, I guess, I have a Twitter, and every so often I'll post some extremely stupid edit video sort of thing. Mostly, I'm just trying to help people make like video. Like the last thing I did was I made a little trailer for the hymn to the Earless God Kickstarter that just finished up the other day successfully, which was great to see. Really, really awesome. Wonderful last minute push for it. But in general, I'm not really out there to be found. You'll just see me when you see me, and that's good with me.
And Cole, I know you are making a lot of podcasts over at duckfeed.tv.
Far too many. Yeah, no. Over at the duckfeed.tv network, people who like this show would, I think, most enjoy Watch Out for Fireballs. Been going for about, we just passed our 12th anniversary, I believe. It's wild, doing deep dives into games. On our premium offering, we just finished up our in-depth coverage of Elden Ring on Bonfireside Chat is the show that'll be coming back when we do the when the DLC comes out. But we're going to be launching a new thing here. We're going to be doing in-depth coverage of Baldur's Gate 3 on a new podcast that we're launching called Real Lich Hours. So that's going to be coming out later on in the year. But yeah, duckfeed.tv for those shows. And then you can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky just at my name. It's spelled weird, KOLEROSS.
And as for me, I am Bob Mackey. I've been the host of this one. You can find me on Twitter or X, the Everything app, as Bob Servo. And I'm also on Blue Sky as Bob Servo. I don't really post there. I mostly just lurk. But maybe I'll be driven to become a Blue Skyer at some point. And my other podcasts, are all on the Talking Simpsons Network. That's at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. There's Talking Simpsons, our chronological exploration of The Simpsons. We have What a Cartoon, where we go over a different cartoon from a different series every month. And then we also have some fun stuff on the Patreon, like a series about Futurama, a series about King of the Hill. We've covered Batman and Mission Hill and The Critic. We've been doing it for over 6 years. So if you want to hear about cartoons and my thoughts on them, and also Henry Gilbert's thoughts, head on over to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. But that has been another episode of Retronauts. We'll see you again next time. Take care.